think boardrooms are very, very conscious of climate change. And they also have amongst their staff many people who are really, really conscious of climate change. One of the things that's become clear in recent years is that the younger generation do not really get out of bed just to make money. Many of them have a much broader view on life. And as we've seen, climate change is something which really motivates the younger generation.
I can today announce that the UK government has decided to become the world leader in low-cost clean power generation, cheaper than coal, cheaper than gas. And we believe that in 10 years' time, offshore wind will be powering every home in the country, with our target rising from 30 gigawatts to 40 gigawatts.
The voices first of the Baroness Wheatcroft, the business expert now in the House of Lords, on how critical the green agenda is becoming to purpose-driven business. And then the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, ushering in an era in which not only would the sale of all petrol and diesel cars now end by 2030, but the amount of offshore wind power will be quadrupled within a decade.
Welcome to a new podcast series, Purposeful Investments, brought to you by Pension Insurance Corporation, otherwise known as PIC, a specialist insurer of defined benefit pension schemes, taking a look at the powerful financial, regulatory and cultural issues which form the relationship between finance and society. I'm Emma Nelson, and this series is all about finance with a social purpose, how the pensions we save for not only give us a secure financial future, but also positively help the environment, the economy and future generations. This series looks at ESG, or environmental, social and governance investing, an evolving framework which is meant to help investors judge the long-term sustainability and the social impact of their investments. And the topic of today's programme is
the seismic changes around sustainability and the green agenda. In order to do justice to just how hot a topic green issues are once again, this is a somewhat extended episode, and here's a taste of what's coming up.
Governments are going to come under increasing pressure to use their central banks as a way of influencing policy, and for the central banks to be demanding collateral that is green. There has to be a debate about the taxonomy of such collateral and what is brown and what is green, and of course there's going to be huge pressures. But it is going to be the quickest way of ensuring that companies transform their energy sources when central banks start demanding assets or collateral that is considered to be green.
What we're seeing is learning curves come down across all those technologies and bring down the costs of those technologies on an average unbelievable percentage per annum. Take solar, that's seen an increase in efficiency per annum of about 28% per annum. So every year, the cost of producing effectively a solar panel comes down by about 20 to 28% per annum. In wind, it's been going slower, about 11%. But lithium-ion batteries have been running at around about 15% per annum. And there's a step change coming in the next 2 years where you see the step change get to less than $100 per kilowatt hour. Why is that important? Because that means it's cheaper than an internal combustion engine.
Clips from a fascinating discussion between the economist Anne Pettifer and Mark Lacey of investment firm Schroders will be joined by Hartej Singh of PIC. But first, back to Boris Johnson. The Prime Minister has made going green a central plank of his environmental policy agenda. In addition to the changes around offshore wind and cars, he said, and I quote, "Your kettle, your washing machine, your cooker, your heating, your plug-in electric vehicle. The whole lot of them will get their juice cleanly and without guilt from the breezes that blow around these islands." So let's pick up on that with a perspective from someone who knows a thing or two about the green agenda when it comes to washing machines, cookers and the like. The marketing guru, John Grant. I caught up with John to ask him to set the green scene for us, and I began by inviting him to introduce himself.
My name is John Grant. I am the author of 8 business books, the most recent being Greener Marketing, which was a sequel to my previous Green Marketing Manifesto, as well as writing books. I consult with a huge variety of businesses, ranging from very established corporates like IKEA, the BBC, Cisco, IBM, through to quite a lot of entrepreneurial startups.
Right, let's begin then. It's what, 13 years since you published the Green Marketing Manifesto?
The new book was originally going to be a new edition with the old principles and new examples. And it was a presentation I'd given for a Finnish media group and the Prime Minister's Office in Finland, where they asked, how can we advise our national businesses on sustainable marketing? And what I did was I just updated the principles of the old book with new examples. So where we had Toyota Hybrid before, now we had Tesla and so forth. And the principles still held quite well. But I really wanted to write a new book, which I did this time, because there was a lot of new things happening. So a lot of new trends hitting business, like plant-based diets, ESG indexes, all sorts of things. And also the whole issue of purpose. Way back 13 years ago, lots of people in larger organizations have done a visions and value exercise and put a mission statement on the wall. But the extent to which brands and indeed companies could be driven by a purpose that, as the CEO of Unilever puts it, is greater than cleaning your clothes or washing your hair, had become quite a dominant part of the current scene, certainly in marketing. And issues like that I just wanted to cover, so it was easier to write a fresh book.
In the 13 years since the Green Marketing Manifesto, you've introduced a couple of ideas there, but what has actually changed? Because at the point when your first book came out, marketing and sustainability seemed to be positioned as two absolutely opposite ideas, and they now, that's changed, hasn't it?
I think what's shifted this time is that genuinely there are a number of organisations which are going beyond the old definition of sustainability, which was something to do with risk management and reporting, and it was an addendum to the main business of a business. It was a, you know, a corrective, and responsible, nice companies with good values would want to be responsible, but it was a small corrective, whereas now it's quite central. If you're a food company, you're very interested in both ends of the chain, so regenerative farming and actually really pushing to meet your science-based targets through your supply chain, but also offering things to consumers, like I mentioned, plant-based foods. It's become central to business strategy. I think that's because a generation of leadership have listened to people like Greta at Davos and gone, there is an emergency. If organizations of our size don't respond to that, who will? Many of those European business leaders signed the Alliance for a Green Recovery. They're committing to that even through the difficult times that we have now, because they recognize that this is a necessity and it can drive innovation. The first big company I worked with on sustainability was IKEA. If you're going to take your factories with you and ensure everything from the fact they have a fire extinguisher to they have the, you know, the greenest technology at their disposal, then you're going to have to make resources. So, for instance, financing available to those organizations to help them transition in the way you're asking to. And very large companies with huge supply chains. So Walmart has been incredibly forward on sustainability. It was back in 2006-07 and it is again. It's made renewed commitments recently, and they have to work with their suppliers, some of which are the huge companies like P&G and Unilever, and others of which are supplying smaller items, you know, their fresh produce section and so forth, wouldn't all be related to huge global multinationals. And Marks and Spencer's the same with their plan A. They had to go and work with the factories that made their jumpers and socks and supplied their ready meals and work with them to achieve these. I mean, I think the thing about large companies is that, you know, when you deal with the leaders of large companies, it's sort of like being on an ocean-going tanker. It's incredibly difficult to turn the boat. They look longingly at the agility of Silicon Valley venture-funded businesses that can simply pivot their business model and go, okay, we're now B2B, not B2C, and so forth, because large companies find it incredibly difficult to change their ways of working and ways of thinking to incorporate radical change. They're almost designed to produce the same as last year with 3-4% growth. That's core of what they do.
What about the green financial models that we're looking at? There's an awful lot of pressure on every single company now to not only recover from COVID, but to recover in a green way. Where is it that finance is actually able to play a green role?
Well, finance is somewhere at the heart of it. I came to the conclusion with my last book that actually all roads lead to money, and whether you're talking about government policy linked to GDP growth, or individual companies being able to finance a transition to the green economy and to thrive in 10, 20 years' time. So sustainability-linked loans have grown from almost nothing 3-4 years ago to $40 billion in 2019. And they've shifted from kind of industrial loans to things like water utilities, to deals with people like the retail chain of Prada, they are a way of rewarding green behaviours. We need leadership and direction within finance, and we need something between regulators and banks that are billing themselves as being part of the sustainable future that doesn't drive unsustainable growth and doesn't drive money to credit cards, which people can blow on fast fashion and gas-guzzling cars. So there needs to be some shift, but ultimately, every pound spent in the economy is responsible for about 0.5 of a kilogram of carbon emissions, and it doesn't matter too much whether you spend that on an organic carrot or a T-shirt. It's sort of a bell curve, and every time you spend, you emit carbon. We are decarbonising, but not fast enough for us to just keep spending as we are. So we need to adjust. And I think one of the really positive things coming through COVID crisis is that people have been reflecting on whether all of their lifestyle spending was necessary, all the things that we buy when we're restless and commuting and endlessly chasing our tail. And I think people are genuinely taking sustainability or regenerative business to their heart now and looking for a way to be a company which is recognised as making a positive contribution to society. What we're seeing with sustainability and finance is a really necessary shift from the short-termism of equity investment and very short-term holding. And I think for us to adopt sustainability within finance and for the finance industry to drive it, then the asset owners, the pension companies, the people making long-term investments, and most of sustainability makes sense if you look over a 10 to 50 year horizon. And if you make decisions on that timeline, then you won't have unsupportable climate risk on your balance sheet. And you will be investing in the future green economy because you simply have a view that that's where the value is in future. So I think it's a very positive move. The voices that we've heard in the market of central banks and large asset holders, asset management and pension companies. And we need that. So I think finance, really, money still makes the world go round. We just need to make it go round differently and slower. And we need to create a business model that transitions from having a business model for hydrocarbons and unsustainable growth to a business model for things like ecosystem restoration and decarbonisation of infrastructure. And I think only those long-term actors can bring that model.
Well, let's bring in some long-term actors, as John calls them, experts who each take a long economic view on the finances around the green agenda and the E part of ESG, although they are, of course, all connected. With much of global policy around everything from electric cars to hydrogen suddenly gaining traction from Washington DC to Whitehall, we want to know what this will mean in practical and purposeful terms for the long-term investment market. Mark Lacey is head of resource equities at Schroders. He looks after investors who want to focus on the energy transition that we're all experiencing. Hartej Singh is a portfolio manager at Pension Insurance Corporation. He looks after long-dated bonds to pay for the pension liabilities. And Anne Pettifer is an economist and director of Prime Policy Research in Macroeconomics. She's also the author of The Case for the Green New Deal, a book which was published last year.
Welcome, all of you. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Let me begin with you, Mark. The pace of the push towards us all using different types of energy now is breakneck, isn't it?
It is, but I think we're only in the first innings, and it's going to accelerate from here, not decelerate, because you've had consumer take-up and you've had costs. Costs have improved massively in the last 10 years. You don't need subsidies anymore for this to be viable. So it's economically viable from a utility perspective, but also from a consumer perspective for these technologies. You've had government policy at a light touch, though, if you go back to 2010. But if you take the government change in government policy in particular during COVID, because that's when the Green Deal accelerated within Europe, but you also look at stimulus from China and you look at Joe Biden, then you're going to see an absolute global policy coordinated, and that's very important, and that's when you get the acceleration of the investment levels.
Anne, tell us about this light touch that the government is being accused of having here by Mark.
Well, absolutely, and that is changing, and it is being led by Europe. I mean, Europe has committed and has upgraded its targets for greenhouse gas emissions reduction for a greater share of renewables in energy supply to 55% by 2030.
In the middle of all this is the investor, HeartEdge, deciding where on earth to put their money that they know is not only going to save the planet, but also give a nice steady return for your pensioners.
I think that is a debate that we're having all the time. And the investment landscape in terms of bonds does not have much renewable energy in it. In fact, if you look at lots of the benchmark indices that we get to choose from, there's still a high proportion of it in traditional oil and gas, i.e. carbon type investments. We believe that if the economics change in the way that sort of Mark lays out, then the opportunity for us to be much more involved in renewable energy will happen. We are very much invested in renewable energy in terms of individual plants that produced some renewable energy. However, there is a lot more that government can do to skew the economics in favour of renewable energy.
Mark, you wanted to say something there. I mean, there becomes this issue here is, what does green enough mean?
The investment landscape for HeartEdge is going to improve significantly because you cannot fund this entire value chain upgrade. And it's not just about renewable power generation. It's about transmission and distribution networks, which need to cater for renewable power generation. It's all the component manufacturers. It's providing residential and microgrids, creating microgrids as well, which is very interesting. You're not going to rely on major scale utilities in the future. All that needs funding. Now, it's funding on one side comes from us on the equity side, but you need that balance of debt markets as well. And that's where that market's going to improve significantly for HeartEdge.
Anne, you wanted to say something?
Well, I was going to say that governments are going to come under increasing pressure to use their central banks as a way of influencing policy. For the central banks to be demanding collateral that is green. There has to be a debate about the taxonomy of such collateral and what is brown and what is green. And of course, there's going to be huge pressures. But it is going to be the quickest way of ensuring that companies transform their energy sources is when the central banks start demanding assets or collateral that is considered to be green.
HeartEdge at the moment, and we've just heard comments there from both Mark and Anne who talk about, you know, the future requirements and what people are going to be obliged to do. But as it stands at the moment, what simple choices are you being forced to make? Because things are happening incredibly quickly. So do you find yourself suddenly thinking, well, that's a highly carbon heavy company. I'm going to have to divest my interests of that really quickly because otherwise I'm not going to be green enough. I mean, it seems quite simple and quite brutal, but not necessarily the right way to go about things.
So I think when you're lending to a company that is meant to pay you back in 20 years, what could happen in the intervening period is obviously sort of quite broad. I think if the amount of carbon that goes into the environment isn't sort of brought down a considerable amount, then the things that the governments are going to have to do will get more extreme the longer we leave it. So one of the concerns that we're always thinking about is what happens if it's left too late and therefore the measures have to be quite extreme. So when we're thinking about sort of, as you put it, carbon and heavy companies, if they have long-standing maturities, you know, things that we're going to have to take a 20 or 30 year view on, we're very, very uncomfortable about doing that. And certainly the ability for us to invest in those companies is dwindling rapidly.
Mark, tell us a little bit more about that struggle that you get with the issue of, you know, do I divest of the interests which are carbon heavy, but in the full knowledge that once those interests are gone, they're perhaps a little less regulated and people can keep not quite as close an eye on it?
Yeah, it's so easy to put these companies in a bad bucket and a good bucket. You shouldn't do that, particularly for investing. So, and remember, this is a transition and we're talking about a 20 to 30 year transition. Everyone on this call, investors now globally accept that we have to have this structural shift in the energy system. But at the same time, what you can't do is suddenly collapse the existing infrastructure by restricting funding. There are different flavours of companies in that bucket that can basically provide the capital for that transition. So you're seeing a radical change in the business model from BP, and they've got a very drastic change in their business model where they're letting their oil and gas volumes decline over the next 10 years, so at the same time as significantly increasing their renewable energy generation. At the same time, though, there are companies that run the existing pipelines and infrastructure. The people are saying, well, what future do they have? Well, hydrogen changes that overnight. Do not write off hydrogen, because with hydrogen, you can utilize the existing infrastructure in a much more efficient way, so it has a lower carbon footprint, and these companies are still very, very viable. Ultimately, you have to be very careful, and we have to make sure we're funding the companies that are enabling the change or are part of that change just as much as we're funding the companies that are outright investing in the new technologies.
Mark, I would like to pick up on you on that and the issue of hydrogen. I think Airbus has recently announced that it's going to be carbon neutral, but what if all the other aircraft manufacturers, I mean, one can think of Boeing, decides to go, well, actually, we're going to go electric, and you suddenly find yourself going down various different routes of renewable energy, and only one will be the winner, and that's going to lead to a lot of losers.
I don't think in any of these technologies that one technology is the winner. We've already seen it in renewables in terms of wind and solar. We're seeing it in different designs in loads of technologies globally, whether it's communication devices. There isn't always just one winner. Competition is healthy for the consumer. You want competing technologies. If they both achieve the same goal of reducing emissions, but that also they achieve a return, suitable returns for our investors, then we're more than happy to back either of those technologies. However, that return scrutiny has to come into play, otherwise we're not performing our role for our investors.
And what would you say to that?
All I'd say is that, you know, we need to be careful, because giving these big companies choices between one form of energy and another is all very well. But by then, the market might have collapsed. You know, people may not be flying. And in which case, really, there's a whole sector for replacement and renewal. And I think we just can't underestimate it. The climate risks are very, very grave and have been underestimated consistently. And the other risk, you know, the biodiversity risk, which we don't normally talk about when we talk about climate change, is the risk that has given us a pandemic. And the scientists are telling us that it'll give us more. Now, that's going to alter the story very dramatically and very quickly.
Let's stay with you, Anne, because we can move on to the idea of who's going to lead the way in this. It's not long since the former governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, said that for far too long, governments have really, really been taken over by the private sector in terms of pushing for remedying climate change. How much can you actually put things on the doorstep of governments and saying they've actually been left behind in all this?
You can give them a lot of responsibility, but I would give even more responsibility to the economists advising those governments, basically. I mean, the advice, for example, that Nordhaus gave, which led him to win a Nobel Prize, was that it was more costly to address the climate crisis 10 years ago than it would be in 30 years' time. And that advice was hopeless. So the economists have got a lot to answer for. And so have governments. Water is the new asset, you know. At the very moment that California is burning and has a finite water supply, is the moment that the market decides that there's going to be a market in water. Wall Street decides there's going to be a market in water. And the fact that governments are allowing that to happen is a very, very big problem, but it's not one that I see any government intending to reverse.
Mark, what would you say to that, that actually it's the advisors who've been getting it wrong?
I don't disagree with Anne at all, but I do think it's not just the advisors, and I don't think that's what Anne was saying. I think there's a lot of people who are getting it wrong. The consumers have been getting it wrong as well, if we take it to the next step. I mean, let me just give you a perfect example, which everyone can relate to. The fastest growing market in internal combustion engines in China in the last 5 years has been the massive SUV market up until literally 2019. So you had the biggest engines and the consumers were demanding this. I mean, that's contributing to all these, one tiny contributor, which when you add it all up together, though, has a massive impact. So it's not just the advisors, it's the consumers as well. But information now is considerably better quality than it's ever been. So we have all the information, we've got all the evidence, and this is what's changing everyone's views towards this.
Harted, your thoughts on all this?
So I think one part of the market that we haven't talked about as much is the regulation of carbon. If the problem is that effectively it is very costly to remove carbon from the atmosphere, then effectively it means that those who release carbon into the atmosphere are sort of creating negative externalities, i.e. they're doing harm to the environment that they're not paying for in some way. There are a couple of ways that you can sort of skew this, and this is sort of why I think asset owners, who are effectively the end investors in all this, why we should be sort of a significant part of this, is we need to put money into the technologies that Mark is talking about. There needs to be a decent set of incentives for us to sort of put the capital to renewable energy. But also in the second part is those who pollute effectively need to have this costed effectively, because ultimately, if societies as a whole are going to have to take on this cost, it's probably fair that those who contribute most to the pollution that will pay. And so when we look at the horizon, those business models which are effectively creating pollution but not paying for it right now are the ones that we think could be the most at risk.
Can I just add a note of optimism here? You know, I quite take Mark's point about SUVs in China and also coal mines in China and the fact that they're burning more coal and indeed in parts of Eastern Europe. But the change can be incredibly rapid. If you look at the city of New York, 10 years ago, a lot of people were on scooters. Now there are no scooters in New York and only electric bikes. Now, Asia is very dependent on scooters. And so, you know, there could be a very rapid transition there. The market plus the climate plus nature is going to hasten all of these processes. My worry and the question that I would like to put to Haritej is the question of very low yields on valuable assets like US treasuries. And that, for me, is a sign of fear. That, for me, is a sign that the economy is not being managed properly, of imbalances in the economy, of very high levels of debt relative to finite assets, assets that are shrinking. You know, water is a shrinking asset. Coal is a shrinking asset, is potentially a distressed asset. But against it are leveraged huge sums of debt. On the one hand, that's a threat to the global economy, that level of debt versus actual income to repay the debt. And then secondly, the very low yields on these valuable assets that more and more people want to buy because the only thing that's safe these days, it feels, government debts, US treasuries and British gilts.
I can totally see where you're coming from. Obviously, low yields is not as good for people in terms of trying to save for their retirement and save for sort of future expenditure. So those people who, sort of, let's say, are savers because they've come to the end of their career, you know, are finding it tough to make the kind of same return that they would on their capital. Whilst yields are sort of historic lows, and I don't think there's any debate about that, the amount you're getting paid for credit risk right now is at the sort of long-term average. So whereas we can understand that, I guess, people who are deciding between whether they invest in government bonds or corporate bonds, we certainly see corporate bonds sort of paying a reasonable premium over the government bonds.
They're so risky, surely, Hatas. That's because they are so much more risky, because corporate debt levels are really high.
Corporate debt levels are high, and that might be a function of the low interest rates. I guess if you're not paying that much in interest, perhaps you can accumulate more debt. I think that's part of the challenge that people who would sit in my seat face, which is given that there are potential sectors where there's some risks that we've described and there's potential new opportunities, but those new companies probably don't have the size or the track record of some of the traditional companies. Just making sure that we're able to invest when the companies that sort of Mark sees as the emerging winners need the capital, we want to be available for that opportunity.
What about the geography of all this? Anne was mentioning the United States, and we've mentioned China, we've mentioned the European Union. But Mark, let's try and unpick this a little bit. Some say, OK, don't invest in China because in terms of their influence and their carbon production, they're the climate change baddies when it comes. But nonetheless, they have such a large control over solar power, lithium ion batteries, wind turbines. They are, on the face of it, the future of green.
They are the future, and you can't just paint China with a tarred brush every time we speak about China. They've been leaders in actually driving the cost down in polysilicon and manufacturing. Now, there is a negative attached with that, which is a lot of their power production at the moment is obviously through coal, which needs to be reduced significantly. But we've started to see, and we invest in manufacturers that have actually got renewable power generation for bringing down, for producing polysilicon. And secondly, they've got their own stimulus package, which in reality dwarfs that of Europe. It's a $2 trillion stimulus package aimed at renewable programs in different states within China to get at a minimum requirement of renewable power generation. So they are the cost leaders. Emma, I will say lithium-ion batteries, the leaders are actually in Korea, not China. It's actually Samsung and LG Chem. We already use their technology. You already use it in your phone, as you already do, and Anne's already highlighted the scooters, and we're seeing a massive pickup in that technology. What we're seeing is learning curves come down across all those technologies and bring down the costs of those technologies on an average unbelievable percentage per annum. If I was to take solar, so that's seen an increase in efficiency per annum of about 28% per annum. So every year, the cost of producing effectively a solar panel comes down by about 20 to 28% per annum. In wind, it's been going slower, about 11%, but lithium-ion batteries have been running at around about 15% per annum. And there's a step change coming in the next 2 years where you see the step change get to less than $100 per kilowatt hour. Why is that important? Because that means it's cheaper than an internal combustion engine suddenly. So the consumer can suddenly have an electric car.
Can I take you up on that? Because there are finite amount of lithium as well. And by making it cheaper, we're consuming it faster. That's what worries me is the way in which we think about the assets that we need for these, even for renewables, is we think about them as being infinite in supply, and they're not. They're very finite. And so making them cheaper is also risky, is it not?
It is. It is for everything that we use and consume on a daily basis. And I think it's a very valid point. But this is why we are investing in companies which provide the renewable and recycling for lithium-ion batteries. So take Umicore in Europe. They're the number one leader in basically recycling batteries, taking the cathode out and effectively reusing it. And as you use lithium in your home, you create that microgrid. You won't get the degradation as you to the same extent you think you will use. And there's loads of different battery technologies, like solid state, for example. Hydrogen fuel cells will be used as well. It comes back to what you said earlier. One technology is not the solution, but the speed of the transition is going to happen. It's going to be very, very fast. So if we want to do this in 30 years, we'll need more than one technology. That is absolutely the key, Anne. And bear in mind, the last time we've had structural shifts in the energy system, it's taken 70 to 100 years for it to take place.
Yeah.
So this is condensing a ridiculous amount of investment in a 30-year period, which is a massive challenge, but it's a much-needed opportunity at the same time.
Let's move on to the future there and how we tackle that problem at such speed. I mean, Heart Edge, it all comes down to the asset owners, doesn't it? I mean, the purpose of finance suddenly comes right to the core, doesn't it?
Absolutely. We hope to be a part of this transition, and we feel like our long-term horizon allows us to be sort of significant players in this. If people are trading on a shorter-term view, perhaps sort of investing in this kind of infrastructure isn't exciting for them. But this is very much front and centre of what we do. We invest in infrastructure around water, utilities. The energy transition will involve a significant overhaul of a lot of the way we distribute energy. That will require money, and that will require long-term capital.
And if I'd like to return to what you were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, which was you mentioned the example of the European Union taking the great steps. I think all 27 members haven't quite decided, but the Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has decided that our infrastructure, well, the European Union's infrastructure, will be part of what's known as, I think it's called, the European Bauhaus. Very much connected with this is the post-COVID recovery, the determination for states to recover in a green manner. How possible do you think this is, given the fact that most people currently in the short term are trying to get enough people to do business with them, to work out how they're ever going to meet again, let alone work out whether they're going to be completely restructured in a climate-compliant way?
I see some very optimistic changes. I see Germany taking a very different view, Germany suddenly realising that governments have to step in here, the public sector has to step in and play a constructive role. And Europe is beginning to think about creating a safe asset across the European Union. In other words, another equivalent to US Treasury bills. And this is, you know, just not a moment too soon. Olaf Scholz made a speech recently, the German finance minister, which in my view was extremely progressive and very different from what we've normally heard from German finance ministers. So I think governments are beginning to see this pandemic has frightened people, has frightened governments, and has actually also in Europe caused them to accelerate processes that in the past they've refused to do. You know, what I'm looking forward to, and what I actually welcome about what has happened over the pandemic, is that fiscal policy and monetary policy has tended to work together in tandem. Whereas in the past, what we've had is fiscal policy being subordinate to a dominant or, you know, assertive monetary policy. And that's just not the way the macroeconomics works. We need to have them both working together.
Mark, I saw you smiling there where she talked about different interests. How much do you welcome the path that Anne has just described?
Well, I was in complete agreement with Anne. So I was smiling because I agree. Coming back to what we were discussing on policy, if the US adopts this policy, which everyone, it's not just about the US. I just want to reiterate that. Bear in mind, the US stepped away from the Paris Agreement. So if the US bring on this policy and they run with other nations, it will encourage other nations to actually accelerate the policy as well. So the US has a massive impact, not just on the rates of investment in the US, it has a massive impact on the rates of investment, particularly in South America, particularly in India, because everyone will start to be coordinated, because it has to be a coordinated effort. A massive, massive section, which Hartesh touched on this earlier, massive through carbon taxes, but a massive section of the Green Deal report, which was issued in November, is Europe cannot do this alone. And we will have to have border controls for nations that are not participating in this effort. That's a very important part of the Green Deal report.
Hartesh, where does that leave the long-term institutional investor?
I think this will happen sooner rather than later. If we are to get ahead of this and make the transition orderly, which is what I think we want as investors, then swift action is required. If this is left another 3 to 5 years, then unfortunately each measure that we're trying to bring will have to be that bit more draconian.
When it comes to ESG, the environment bit, the E, seems recently very much to have taken centre stage. Would you say that the environmental priorities have come at the expense of the S and the G, the social and the governance elements, Mark?
Absolutely not. I think they're all working hand in hand now. We have a massive ESG overlay across our portfolios here, and it's increasing throughout the whole of Schroders, as you can imagine, and governance in particular, particularly around compensation and reporting, is something that we focus on a lot as well. So no, I think they're all working hand in hand at this point in time. And again, it's availability of information. That's the key thing.
And the climate change agenda has been extremely loud recently. Do you think it perhaps has dominated at the expense of other elements?
Well, I think, yes, it has. And I worry that actually there might have been people caring perhaps about both the environment and the social aspects, but there's very little interest in the governance issues. And that worries me. If speculators are able to invest in a finite supply of water at a time of fires across the whole continent, then we know that there's not sufficient governance here. And by that, I mean, you know, state regulation, as well as, you know, the regulation of funds and so on. I think it's a worry.
Hartesh, same question to you.
The social and governance risks were well flagged before, and I think it's only now that people are potentially seeing a risk to their investments that the environment is starting to be more of a topic, because there is a clear outcome which could lose people money. So that's sort of focusing people on it.
Hartesh Singh, Mark Lacey and Anne Pettifer, thank you very much indeed for joining me. I'd like to thank all our guests for focusing our minds on the issues around green finance and technology, markets, and indeed green marketing in this episode. That's John Grant, whose latest book is Greener Marketing, Mark Lacey, Head of Resource Equities at Schroders, The Economist, Anne Pettifer, whose latest book is The Case for the Green New Deal, and Hartesh Singh, a portfolio manager at Pension Insurance Corporation, as well as the Baroness Wheatcroft, who you heard from at the beginning. If you'd like to hear more in this series, head to www.pensioncorporation.com and the tab Purpose of Finance.
I'm Emma Nelson, and this has been an editorial intelligence production for Pensions Insurance Corporation. The executive producers are Jeremy Apfel and Julia Hobsbawm. Assistant producer is Callum McRae.
Thank you for listening.